The New York Times, Rolling Stone, and critics everywhere are all raving about Annihilation.
It's not destroying. It's making something new.
It's a mind-blowing experience. And now it's certified fresh on Rotten Tomatoes. Annihilation. Rated R. Now playing.
On today's Greg Ratliff podcast, we're going to be doing something a little bit different. Talking music today with Neil Bledsoe from Memphis, Tennessee. We're going to talk about all the various projects that he's a part of. Talk about just his life as a musician in Memphis in general. It's going to be some fun conversation. But definitely, if you've got kids around, you may not want to let them, depending on what they're, you're okay with your kids listening to. Me and Neil both kind of, it's a little more adult today. So if you don't want your kids to hear some choice four-letter words, you may not want to listen to the show or listen to it when they're not around. So fair warning. The language is a little bit R-rated, but it was a fun conversation with Neil. It was a lot of fun, and I think you guys will really enjoy it too. So without further ado, I'm going to give you my conversation with Neil. Oh, and before I forget, when the podcast is all done, going to have a debut track from Neil. You guys have heard a clip from it online if you follow Neil on social media. Going to have a full preview of the track Him and Her off his upcoming Goldie EP, split EP with Ed Harris. So that's going to be a lot of fun. I can't wait for you guys to hear this song. It is amazing. But yeah, if kids are around, maybe don't let them listen to this podcast, or at least you can listen to it first and see if it's okay for them to listen to. But yeah, here's my talk with Neil Bledsoe.
That got us all in the positive mood.
That's good. I'm ready when you are.
So if you haven't figured out already, that's Neil Bledsoe on the other microphone in here. And Neil, welcome. How you doing?
Good. How are you, Greg?
I am.
Thanks for having me.
I'm terrific. So I wanted to have you in here because you're doing a bunch of really cool stuff musically in the city of Memphis. And people will be like, who the hell is Neil Bledsoe? I don't know who this guy is.
Right.
Tell people about yourself, like bands, your interests.
Well,
how to get you to go on a date, that kind of stuff.
Well, I gotta go. I'll see you later. Well, I was a singer. Still, I'm a singer. Chaos Order. I've been a singer of that band for probably 6 to 7 years now. Done the most things I've ever done in music has been with that band. Since then, I've done am doing Cruelty of the Heavens, singer, guitar player in that band. It's a kind of a 90s alternative nod. And here recently I've been able to do a project on my own called Goldie that is going to be released as a split with Ed Harris, which Ed Harris has been around forever in Memphis.
If you don't know the name, you've probably seen him somewhere before, playing in some band at some point.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. every band imaginable, Ed is... played drums in, and I think this
has he been in Black Oak, Arkansas?
I don't know. That is the band, like, I mean, everybody, my grandfather played in that band for a little while. I'm just kidding, he didn't play in that band, but I mean, you could see it.
So the Goldie thing, this is the thing that I'm most interested in right now. I mean, I'm interested in all of it, but this Goldie thing is ridiculous. Kind of describe the music that you and Ed are doing on this split EP.
Ed's side is a little bit more experimental as far as some of this stuff sounds like it could have been like Danny Elfman wrote it in a way. You know what I mean? Like, he's on a different level as far as the way he writes songs. Ed is his brain goes a lot further than mine does when it comes to writing, because I get to a certain point and then I don't want to go any further. You know what I mean? I'm kind of like more of a straightforward kind of person, but it's, I don't really know how to explain it. Like, if you're a fan of projects like City in Color, and you like, there was Owen. I don't know if you remember that band at all, Owen. It was the guy that left American Football and went and did that by himself.
Oh, yeah.
But that's just kind of like, it's things that I've written that I couldn't use in Chaos Order at all, and things that I couldn't use really in Cruelty. So had some downtime, recorded the music, and
sure.
I'm always doing something. Like, if I get bored, I guess I'll write a song. You know, somebody goes and does yard work, I'll write a song. And so I just had three songs that I didn't know what I was going to do with, and Ed luckily had three songs that he didn't know what he was going to do with either. And actually, Ed joined Cruelty to the Heavens. This is the first time he's played guitar in like 15 years in a band, and he's doing really well at it. So
when I saw that first, the first thing I thought in my mind was like, I think I used to sell him drum stuff at Guitar Center when worked there.
Oh, yeah.
So
he's been through there several times, and there's a lot of money there.
I'm glad you mentioned the City in Color thing, because the first time I heard the Goldie song that was posted online.
Him and Her?
Instantly I was, and I mean it in a completely complimentary way. I don't mean it as like a, you sound just like this guy. No, but that's instantly I was like, he's got it figured out right there. Like that's the sound right there.
Yeah,
it's awesome.
It's been a fun thing, man. And I'm glad that it's going to actually come out with Ed, because honestly, after I got done with it, I didn't know what I was going to fully do with it, just because I don't want any money. I don't want to charge people for it, because I feel like in 2017, that's kind of fucking corny to me. Like, hey, I wrote this song, I want you to pay for it now. You know, and it just kind of... So we figured out that I wanted to donate everything to charity originally, just by myself, and Ed is on board with me with that, too. He's on fire for, to just go ahead and just give it all to charity.
Nice.
We've got a couple in mind that we're trying to figure out which one's going to be the best one to go with, just because we want to go with one that is really important, but it's not in the limelight. You know, as far as they could really, really use the money. So we've got a couple that we're talking to, and we're going to have that figured out by the time it's released.
How is that now with how the music business is now, from whatever level of the business you're at? That before, it used to all be about, we got to have albums to sell at shows, we got to have this to sell, got to have that to sell, and now everybody's giving their music away for free. Like, I've been playing in bands since 2001, two. It's about 15, 16 years now. And, that was the whole thing back then, is you got to get an album recorded, and then you got to sell that album at your shows, got to sell merch at the shows, got to do this, this, this. And now it's just kind of like, here, I'm going to put the songs on Bandcamp for free. Go ahead. If you want to give me money for them, you can give me money for them. Right. If you don't want to, you don't have to.
I think a lot of people's attention span, too, is a lot shorter now, because there's gigantic bands that are doing EPs instead of full links. Because, I mean, in the next 6 months, people are wanting something else. You know, they want something else. Like, they're just kind of like, well,
you don't have 2-3 years between albums
cool,
anymore.
But what else do you got? You know, just kind of. So bands don't really. It's a rare thing to see a lot of people doing just a full length now, because you can, with the EP, you can put out more music more frequently than here's an LP. We'll see you in 2 years, kind of thing. You know what I mean?
How has technology kind of changed the way that somebody like you does things when it comes to the simplicity of getting music out to people?
Oh, gosh. I mean, it's just, we recorded the Cruelty record in our practice room. So it's been really nice. It's convenient, and it's
kind of weird to think like 10, 15 years ago doing something like that, you'd been
it
like,
was unheard of.
There's no way you could do something like
that.
No,
you listen to that record and you think that we've spent like $700,000 on it or something.
You guys went to Arden and did that album, didn't you?
We were we were down the street from Ardent in our practice room recording every piece of that, and some of it at Dave Cowell's house, the guy that recorded the whole record.
Awesome.
So it's really nice, and it's convenient, especially if you've experienced the studio setting before. It's very boring. It's nicer to be in an element that you're comfortable with, because I think the songs come out better. It's a better time. It's more fun. You're not on a clock. It's not as sterile. Is what I'm trying to say.
The last time I recorded in a studio was the most, like, one of the most interesting experiences of my life, because it was just, it was a two, like, a day long process where we literally recorded was two songs.
Yeah. It used to be like that. You know, it would be, bands would go in the studio and it would take half a year or a year to produce something. Now it's a matter of weeks, that somebody can get something recorded and be done with it.
I love technology. Like, I'm using the technology right now. I've got a computer that I'm recording everything into. No tape, no CD, no mini disc. Or when I first started doing radio, God, I sound like an old man now. Back in my day, we recorded everything to mini disc.
Right.
Yeah. The little flash drive I've got here, this existed, but I think you could only get it in like a 256 megabyte.
Oh, wow.
And I bought one not too long ago that's 32 gigabytes.
Nuts, man.
The other day, I'm not even kidding you, I they were showing some article on probably on Facebook, and it was a micro SD card that fits 128 gigabytes on it. My first computer, desktop computer that stood like, you know, 2 feet tall on my counter, was 4 gigabytes. It had a 4 gigabyte hard drive in it. You can get a micro SD card with 128 gigabytes on it.
Things are just, man, man's going to outdo himself eventually. That's what's going to happen. Like, how far you want to take this?
What is that going to look like? What do you think when man finally just gets to that breaking point of like, well, there's nothing else we can do?
I think we're getting to that point now, but that's a whole different podcast. That's on the conspiracy theorist podcast that you haven't done yet, but you're going to eventually.
I'm working my way towards that. I'm already kind of venturing out of the sports realm into this, because this isn't a sports podcast. It doesn't say a sports podcast on it. Well, actually, the description might say sports podcast, but
we could talk about basketball if you want.
You don't have to.
Scrap all this music stuff. We'll talk about sports the whole time.
I'm just going to go back and delete it, and we'll just talk about the 2004 Memphis Grizzlies.
Let's talk about Sean Kemp and the Seattle Supersonics.
I had as a kid, I'm not even kidding you, 5 Sean Kemp rookie cards, and gave every single one of them away to my friends.
So you could have retired.
I could. I don't even think that card's really worth anything now. Let me look that up. I'm gonna look that up. Who's your favorite basketball player as a kid?
Oh God, Anthony Hardaway probably.
Yeah.
You know, I loved Shaq, Michael Jordan, Scott, man, all that, man. Scottie Pippen. Remember the USA team when we went to Japan, cleaned house,
just stomped everybody.
Larry Bird. I mean, you're talking about some of the good ones.
Oh, let me see. I gotta find this Sean Kemp rookie card. I remember it was an Upper Deck. All right, we're going to find
that
out.
Kind of stuff when it's, like, hot. It's sometimes, like, you can't hold on to it very long because then people just don't want it anymore.
Let's see. Sean Kemp. It's not worth hardly anything.
Sean Kemp was a great player, man, but he's – if you were to say that to somebody that's 16 years old right now, they don't even know who –
Who the hell is that?
Who is that? Is that, like, the guy that works down the street at the Gateway Tire place?
I think he works over at Jack Pirtle's. He's assistant manager.
Could be.
You know what I didn't know, and I'm going to sound like such a like transplant when I say this. I didn't know until recently that Jack Pirtle's sold cheeseburgers.
Really? I didn't either until just now.
Really?
Yeah, I never knew that. No, I've always thought it was just chicken.
So I heard a commercial for it on the radio, and they're talking about, oh, the best cheeseburgers in Memphis. I was like, what?
Yeah, I mean, I know that Tops has like a really good burger. But I never liked, you know, that. I never knew that Jack Pirtle's
given these places some free advertising. Hey, if you want to sponsor the show, by all means, reach out.
Send some money and get the address.
So I got to ask, what growing up, what music was kind of, because people that may not know anything about you, what music did you listen to?
What music did I listen to? Well, you start out listening to what your parents listened to, but luckily I had a mom that was like really into a lot of cool stuff, man. She, you know, Led Zeppelin, Kansas, Molly Hatchet, who else? You got to give me a second on this. We got to mull it over here because there's some really good stuff that I'm leaving out. Like, you know, Bob Seger. You had Bob Seger in the house playing real loud.
You know, I'm glad you said Bob Seger. The first song that I remember as a kid being like just like that I was totally into was that Bob Seger song, Shakedown, that was in Beverly Hills Cop.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, man. One of my favorite Bob Seger songs is Fire Lake. It's kind of a B-side song. It wasn't a bigger one. But that's one of my favorites is Fire Lake is awesome. Also, who else? I have it on the tip of my tongue. ZZ Top, man. One of my mom's favorite bands. Like, her first record she ever owned was Thrace Ombres.
Really?
And she paid like $1.25 for it, whatever it was when it came out in the 70s. And fast forward to, you know, 30 plus years, I got to record with Chaos Order in the same room that Thrace Ombres was recorded in.
Wow. You know,
Studio A at Arden. So it was really cool. Like, it's like, oh, coming back around again. But that's one of her favorite bands. So started off listening to that and then just kind of you start picking out the things you like and the things you don't like, and you hear stuff for yourself on what's happening at the time when I was growing up on the radio in the 90s. So you pull from that, and you know, it turns into like Soundgarden, Alice in Chains, Nirvana, mm-hmm. Slow Dive, just a Typo Negative. That's another favorite band of my mom's is Typo Negative.
Really?
I remember listening to Typo Negative.
That doesn't sound like the kind of band that, like, that mom listens to.
Oh, mom listened to it, man. She would She'd get a 40 that Bush beer, dude, and she'd turn on Bloody Kisses, man. It'd just be loud as hell in the house.
The first, this might surprise you, the first album I ever bought that wasn't like a compilation album was Radiohead's OK Computer.
Really? Wow, that's a great album.
Now, I had people over the years, and I used to be one of those kids that recorded everything off the radio, like on my tape player.
Oh, yeah.
So I had all kinds of music and stuff, but I never actually went and bought albums.
Right.
And the first album I bought on cassette at Walmart, and I will never forget this because I was with my parents. I was like, that was like 97, so I was almost like high school age. And I remember buying that. No, I was like, ooh, gosh, probably like 12, 13 years old, I think, when that came out. And my mother was with me. And she always had to monitor all the stuff that I was buying, like, because she bought it for me, I think. And I remember her asking the dude working in the electronics department at Walmart, like, what kind of music is this? Like, is this going to be appropriate for him to listen to? And the dude working there was like, you need to let him buy this album.
Well, luckily, my mom was, like, really open to stuff like that. She allowed me to listen to stuff that probably I shouldn't have been listening to, like Napalm Death, you know, and Cannibal Corpse and things like that.
Yeah.
But she was all about it because I was, like, really into it. I was really into music at the time. And still, I mean, not that I'm not now, but it was just like I was trying to figure this out. I was getting really into it, and
sure.
She wanted me to be into it. That was my thing. One of the first two records I ever owned that were mine, that were bought for me, it was my 11th birthday, and after we cut the cake or whatever, my mom goes, okay, we're going to go to the store tomorrow, and you can pick out two Metallica records. I was like, oh, God, can we end this now? Can we go now? I mean, I don't really care to hang out with you guys anymore. I'm done with this. And I got the Metallica Black album, and I got, I think it was Kill 'Em All is the one that I got. Now, nice. The reason I picked that out is because the cover was cool. So I was kind of like thumbing through it, through their whole collection at the time when CD stores carried more than two copies of records.
Yeah.
So you had the whole discography at the time. And I got Kill 'Em All just because of the cover was, you know, you had the hammer and the shadow of the hand and the blood. You know, you can't not buy that record. I bought, Sepultura Chaos AD based on the cover too.
I don't know if I ever, I'm trying to think, like, as you were saying that, I'm trying to think if I've ever bought any album just based on the, well, you know, when I used to go to thrift stores a lot, and I'd just buy records at thrift stores just based on what the album looked like looking at the artwork on it and everything, like, yeah, this might be worth it.
I know, like, the very, very, very first thing I ever owned musically ever was a cassette tape by that band, late 80s, early 90s. They just missed it. It was Trickster. And me and my dad were in a pawn shop. And the cover of that record, man, looks like a comic book or something.
It's
a lot of wild colors or whatever. And I had to have it. I never heard the band a day in my life. 7 years old or whatever. And he bought it. God awful. Like, it's still awful. I go back and listen to it. But that's the very first thing that I ever owned was a Trickster tape.
Wow.
Yeah. So, which is, it's really impressive because, you know, you listen to that, and that could have been my first impression on music. I don't ever want to listen to music again. This is fucking awful.
You see, I think.
I don't want to play it.
I think people our age have a little bit of a different perspective on music, I think, because when we were kind of at that age where we were really discovering music was that, like, 91 to 96 era.
Oh, yeah.
Where metal was awesome and pop rock music was awesome, and that was when alternative radio really kind of got going. And it just, I mean, my sister was in high school and I was like 7-8 years old when the Black Album came out. So she used to watch MTV. She'd come home from school and from high school and watch MTV all afternoon before my parents got home from work. And every day, Enter Sandman videos on, Unforgiven videos on,
right.
Faith No More.
Great band. that's an excellent band.
Queensryche. I always remember that too, because it was always, they had the, like, little top five or whatever countdown every single day. It was like Metallica and Queensryche and Faith No More, like, every single day.
Right. I know that after the Black Album come out, bands like Queensryche tried to start riding in that whole, you know, element as far as what Metallica was doing with Black Album. Like, you started, like, to hear that kind of stuff because it blew the fuck up. Like, it was gigantic. But kind of lost what I was going to say there. I forgot what point I was going to make to you. Must not have been that important.
I always remember there's a, and a few of my friends that might be listening will know this, that when I was in first grade, so this was 1990 or 91, a kid that was in my class, his name was Adam, he used to come to school wearing, he had a Faith No More sweatshirt. This kid's like 7 years old, mm-hmm. has a Faith No More sweatshirt, and he used to bring the tape with him every day of Faith No More's album, The Real Thing. He used to bring it with him everywhere. And I find out years later, this kid that was like obsessed with Faith No More and used to sing the music at school and everything, he's the cousin of somebody that I've played in bands with like my whole like adult life. I find out like years later that he's that kid's cousin. And I hear all these stories of him riding around his neighborhood with a boombox duct taped to the handlebars of his bike, blaring The Real Thing, riding around the neighborhood, screaming all the words to it. All the neighbors like staring out the windows. And I'm like, who is this kid riding down the street? What is wrong with this kid?
Oh, I know that a lot of people talk about, what is the Angel Dust record for them?
Yeah.
That record's great, man. I mean, it's really good, but, album of the year, I think that album is really, really good, man. Like, I think that's way up there, and the one before that is really well. I can't think of the name of that record. It has Take This Bottle on it, a bunch of songs
mm-hmm.
that are really good. I can't think of that record. King for a Day.
Yeah.
Great record, man. I like Angel Dust just fine, but those two records are really, really good for Faith No More.
Were you a big fan of Guns N' Roses when you were younger?
I kind of liked them a little bit, but it wasn't until later in life that I really started to like them a lot.
Yeah.
I kind of felt just the way they, you know, just the way they looked. They didn't look cool to me, you know, as a kid. Like, I don't like the teased hair, and I don't, you know.
Yeah. I didn't like Motley Crue as a kid for the same reason. I was like, I don't like this. Metallica looked cool because, you know, all black and they've got just the long hair. Long
I grew
hair
my hair because of Lars, man. And I'm so glad that I didn't have the bangs. Like, so, later on looking at him, he has bangs and they look awful.
So did I. I grew my hair out for the exact same reason.
I wanted to be Lars. Like, I wanted to be from, you know, wherever, you know, where's he from? Denmark or whatever?
Yeah. He's a tennis player from Denmark.
I wanted to be really short. I wanted to play a huge drum kit. I wanted to have long hair, and I was going to take up tennis in my free time, but it just didn't work out that way for me.
The first band I was ever in was pretty much a Metallica cover band.
Oh, gosh.
And did that for, from 16 through, like, 19, I think.
What songs you guys play?
We did basically the hits. I mean, we did, Enter Sandman. We played Sad But True. We tried for years to learn how to play Fade to Black right, but they couldn't get the timing down at the end of the song.
What about the solo that's in the beginning of that song?
A Fade to Black?
That really sets it off. He could land that?
Oh, yeah.
I've heard people do that before, and it's always kind of like slightly out of tune.
The dude that played guitar in that band was really good, and he was very unorthodox too, because he played a right-handed guitar upside down.
Oh wow! Because
he was left-handed, so he had to learn when he'd buy the tab books. He'd have to learn everything backwards. So he'd be like, hold on. He'd be sitting there, and I'd be watching his fingers moving on the guitar, and I'd try to go home and play guitar after that. And be like, I couldn't follow it. I'm like, what is he doing? What is he? And then it took me forever to figure out that he was playing upside down.
Wow.
Because I was dumb at the time. I was just a kid that I lucked into playing drums.
There was a guitar prodigy from Memphis like years and years ago called, his name was Sean Lane. And he was in Black Oak, Arkansas as well, but he was like mm-hmm. 15 years old in that band playing, you know, lead guitar for them. But he had a lot of like solo records that he invented all this different stuff, but he would double it up. And
yeah.
Buckethead was a huge fan of his. And didn't know that Sean was doubling all that stuff. He just thought he was playing all of it.
Yeah.
So that's where he figured out how to, like, you know, finger tap, like, with all his fingers or whatever at the same time to replicate that stuff. And it wasn't until later on that he met Sean Lane. And Sean was like, man, that's incredible that you learned that, because I dubbed every bit of that in the studio. So I don't know, like, how you figured that out, but that's incredible, man, because all that stuff is, like, it's doubled.
Oh, my gosh.
So, like, he was going out of his way to figure out some of those Sean Lane songs, man.
We used to do that with a lot of with some of the Metallica stuff that we'd be like, man, we can't get this to sound right, and some finally people would just be like, dude, you know that's like three different guitar parts playing at the same time, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Oh, well, that changes things a little bit.
Right.
We need to get another guitar player for our band.
Right. I know. Early on, when you're getting into music, you just think that it's a group of guys that are drinking beers, they go in the studio, and it just sounds that good.
Yeah.
And then, you know, once you get older, you start to dissect these things, and you realize how hard and how thought out all that stuff is, because what you're hearing on that record is there's a lot of things that bring it that is presented there.
Yeah.
It's not just one guitar, and it's not, you know, it's a lot of different things that make it sound like that on your ears.
I started playing drums, it'd be 15 years ago next month, and the first, I'd say, probably 6 years, I had no idea what I was doing.
Oh, yeah, well, I still don't know what the fuck I'm doing.
Like, the part that got me into it, I wanted to play guitar for my entire life. That's all I wanted to do. I wanted to be a guitar player. I'm like, oh, maybe I could play bass, too, but I wanted to be a guitar player. I was terrible at it, absolutely awful at it. The only reason I ended up playing drums was because I went to a whole group of guys were getting together to, they wanted to form this like massive band. It was a bunch of dudes that weren't in bands. It was like 9 or 10 of us all together, and nobody knew how to play drums.
Oh, wow.
And because I didn't have my own guitar or anything, I was just borrowing somebody else's stuff. They're like, well, why don't you try playing drums? I'm like, oh, okay. I guess I can give it a shot. I've never sat behind a drum kit in my life. And I played like the open hand style, played the hi-hats with my left hand and snare with my right hand.
Carter Beauford.
Yeah. And somebody that I learned from, I hate saying that I learned from him because it was the worst habit ever. He goes, no, you don't play drums that way. You got to cross your hands like this. And for the first 3 months I played drums, I played open-handed.
Right.
And that dude stopped me from doing it. And ruined my left-hand independence for the rest of my life as a drummer.
You could do some really cool stuff when you're playing open hand like that. Like, you can make a lot of stuff happen that, but if it was recorded, you just think, how is he doing it? You don't think about it being open-handed like that.
I had to relearn everything I was doing when he told me to, oh, you got to play with your hands, like, crossed. Oh, man, it's still to this day, like, I'm still mad about it. 15 years ago, I'm still mad about it.
It's taken me a long time to realize it doesn't really matter how you play anything. You know what I mean? Like, if that's the way that you play it, then that's the way that you play it. I understand, like, being really young and influenced.
Yeah.
And wanting to play like one of your guys that you're looking up to or whatever. But
sure.
In reality, it doesn't matter how you really make things happen. The point is that you've made it happen. Really.
I wish somebody had told me that when I was in high school.
Me too. Because I worked really hard to learn, like, Injustice for All, that whole record. From my principal instrument is drums. I'm a drummer.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I became a drummer is because I didn't want to be up front. I want to be behind the drum kit. I don't want to talk. I don't want to sing. I don't want to do any of that stuff. And I got roped into being up front just because nobody else wanted to do it. You know what I mean? I wanted to be in a band with my friends. So eventually I got roped to being up front and singing. I didn't set out to do that.
Sure.
But point of the story, you read these articles later on that Lars, like that, he dubbed some of those drum parts.
Yeah.
He admits to doing that. And so at the time, I'm trying to figure out how Lars has like four fucking arms, like Goro from Mortal Kombat. How's he making that? How's he doing double over double and he's working the hi-hat at the same time?
Yeah.
So I worked really hard to play like other people when I could have just played like myself and it would have been probably just as good, if not better. You know?
I can't remember specific songs, but there were several times over the years that who's the guy that I can't remember his name. He's from Memphis and he was a drummer. He was in that band Course of Nature and he used to shop up at the store.
Oh, Ricky Shelton.
Ricky Shelton.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
He came in the store one day and I talked to him. I said, man, I don't want to be that guy, but I need to ask you about that band. He's like, okay, well, like what about it? And there's that one hit song they had that he's doing this ridiculous, Caught in the Sun.
Caught in the Sun. Yeah, I remember that.
And it has this ridiculous like snare drum roll on it, but he's playing the hi-hats too.
Yeah.
And I asked him, I'm like, how did you do that? And he just stands there and he like looks off in the distance for me. He's like, I don't fucking remember how I did that. And he's like, give me a couple sticks or something. He's like, and he sat there with a snare drum in front of me and taught me how to do it.
Gosh. That singer.
But it took him like 20 minutes to figure out
how he did it. Yeah.
He's like, man, that was, he's like, I don't remember this being that complicated. I'm like, now you see why I'm asking you about it.
Right. I mean, there's things, I mean, that we all know, like, the recording process, and you do, sometimes you do stuff in the studio that you didn't really set out to do, and then somebody like yourself may put you on the spot, like, hey, how did you do that? Like, well, I don't really know, I don't remember fucking I don't know how to do that, I don't really remember. And it was like just one of those fluke deals. Small weird thing with that singer guitar player in that band, he's married to Melissa Joan Hart.
Really?
That's his wife, yeah.
And wow.
I don't know why I know that. I just, I'm in this encyclopedia with music, I guess.
You know what? He said this. That's pretty much what he said to me when I mentioned that band. He goes, he's like, man, nobody's asked me about that band in years.
Mm-hmm. they were like small, like a little, they had a little exposure. And I guess, yeah. I don't know what happened with, I don't know. I wasn't into the band. I didn't like it really. But I remember seeing that video on MTV.
Yeah.
They were like out in a cornfield or something. It was really. You know, really super fucking serious. And
part of it's in like the bedroom of a house, and it's all like sunset lit and everything.
I can't remember. There was some sort of weird generic chorus that kind of just hooked you in.
They all played PRS guitars. And...
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I got to ask you, did you like Creed?
Did I like Creed? Let me see. When My Own Prison came out, that was 1997. Honestly, I thought, like, at that time, I thought it was fucking heavy for some reason. You know what I mean? I just thought, like, man, this is heavy shit.
There wasn't anything like that really on the radio or anything at that time. It was a little, it was different.
But the thing, too, at the time, I was such a huge Metallica fan that I compared everything to Metallica. Like, if he didn't do double bass like Lars, or he didn't play fast or whatever, then it wasn't good to me.
Isn't it amazing how listening to a lot of that metal kind of shaped our opinions on that stuff?
Oh man,
there was so much stuff that as a musician that I'd be like, this isn't that good. He's only using one bass drum.
Let me tell you, man, I was so into Lars and so loyal to that band that once I started venturing out and listening to other bands and listening to how they play their instruments, I didn't even realize, like, you can play drums like that?
Yeah.
Lars doesn't do that. And it's like, Lars isn't that fucking good. You know what I mean? Like, that's the reason he can't fucking do it.
That's, I can't remember what year it was. It might have been like 2003 or 4. I started playing in it. I'll get back to the Creed thing because I got something else I wanted to ask you about that. But I think it was like 2003 or 4. I started playing. I got asked to play in a church band. And, you know, all through high school, I did different church things and stuff. And I was very active in it. And I got asked to be the drummer in a worship band. And I had never done anything but play like metal.
Right.
And that they gave me all this different music to listen to, and they're like, yeah, these are some of the songs that we play and everything. I'm listening to this, I'm like, I'm not gonna be able to do this because I have to play quiet.
Yeah,
I've never played with dynamics in my entire life.
Right,
all I did was just beat the hell out of the drums every time I played.
I'm gonna slam the fuck out of this drum kit in front of the Lord and everybody.
And playing with dynamics, oh my god, it opened up a whole new world to
right.
what I was doing. It was just mind-blowing at the
Once
time.
Once you figure that stuff out and you listen to records where guys are doing it, like, you have a whole new respect for players. It's because a lot of that stuff, I mean, it's tough to play like that. Metal is one thing when you're just giving it everything you've got and you're just playing as fast as you can and you're just slamming. That's one thing. But when somebody says, hey, man, can you slow it down and actually do like some ghost notes on the snare? It's like, ghost notes?
What's a ghost note?
That does that mean it's not even there? Is that what you're saying? I don't know what you mean by that. You know, just kind of, you got like a bass player teaching you how to do a ghost note. The first show I ever played in my entire life was in 2000 or 2001. I can't remember. I want to say 2001, so don't quote me. But it was at a church in the gymnasium. They would have bands play mm-hmm. every, like, Saturday or something. And they had it set up. We were in a corner, and there's, like, these bleachers they had brought in. There's people watching us. They didn't care. You know what I mean? They were just there because they didn't want to be at home. You know what I mean? It's like a hangout. Either go to the church gymnasium to lock in or go to Skatelin or whatever.
Yeah.
So, and I played this show with a bass player and another guitar player. We didn't have a singer. We didn't know what the fuck we were doing. Like, we had played, like, one time in a bedroom and didn't have a single song written. We just jammed.
Yeah.
And so it didn't dawn on me until we were setting up in that gymnasium and all these people were sitting there. It was probably 75 people sitting there, kids and adults and everybody. that I was like, we don't have any fucking songs. Like, what? can we cancel this? Because I'm embarrassed. Like, I haven't even started to play yet, but I'm embarrassed already. But we did our thing, and that was it. We never played again after that. Really, we didn't. We never played ever again. That was my first show, man.
First time I ever played in front of an audience, it was the first band I was ever in. It was me and a guitar player and a drummer. Me, a guitar player, and a bass player. My God, I was the drummer. And I was doing the vocals, too, because we couldn't find a singer. We tried all these different people, and couldn't find anybody that could do it.
Why is the drummer roped into stuff like that? Why is it?
Because I don't know.
Hey, man, we don't have a singer. Do you think you can put a headset on and sing?
I don't know if it was I had more confidence in doing it. Because now the guy that was the guitar player in that band, he's the vocalist in every band he's in now.
Oh, wow.
But at that time, the first like 5-6 years he played, he's like, I can't do this. I can't sing in front of people. And now he's fine. And he sounds great. If he would have done it back then, he would have sounded great, too.
I just didn't know he could do it. People. I can't sing in front of like one or two people. I can do it in front of a crowd for some reason, but just one or two people, like especially my family, I cannot even think about wanting to sing a song in front of them.
One of the worst shows my band ever played was when we showed up at this bar and there was only the people we brought with us at the show. Nobody else like off the street came into the show, and it was the worst show we ever played. It's like, thank God there's nobody in this room tonight. Like, good God, I'm glad they didn't show up.
Yeah, I mean, we've all had those nights where it's just like you just want to walk out.
Like the first time we ever played, it's the three of us on stage and we're playing the Nirvana song About a Girl.
Oh wow,
that's a good one. I'm singing it and playing drums. It's an easy song to play on the drums and everything, but it was the first time we'd ever played in front of people. We played in front of 1,600 people.
Wow.
And that was the scariest thing out of all the stuff, all the radio stuff I've done, all the band stuff I've done. I've played in front of much bigger crowds than that now, and that's still that first time. That is the scariest moment of my entire life.
I know, yeah, it is. Being in front of that many people, and they're like just looking at you like, you better do something. Entertain me like right now.
And the bad part is it was at our high school auditorium, and the seats are close enough that you could see the people. So you could see them staring at you.
Oof.
And it's like, oh, my God. I almost passed out when I walked off stage.
That would have been pretty fun. fucking fun, probably, if you'd have done that.
Thank God there was somebody else that, like, comes onto the – they had, like, little stage hands, quote, unquote, that came out and, like, moved all your stuff off stage.
Picked you up off the floor.
They would have had – they almost had to pick me up off the floor because I thought I was going to die, like, right then and there.
There was a show that Chaos Order played at Murphy's. And if you've ever been to Murphy's in Memphis, Tennessee, you know that once you get that room filled up, because it's almost like a shotgun shack, and the stage is set up in the corner, very small stage. You don't need to have four dudes that are 6'3 or taller on that stage at the same time.
Yep.
But once you get in there and you get one person moves, everybody has to move. And I remember being on that stage and all of us, me and Austin and Jared, are jumping around and doing our thing. And I just feel this sting on the top of my head, and it was Jared's headstock of that bass. Hit me right on the crown of my head, man. Oh. And I almost took a knee in front of everybody, but I had to just play it off like everything was fine. But, man, I thought that he had really, like, went into my brain or something, man, with the end of that goddamn bass. That should hurt.
I think we played on a really small stage at this one show at a venue out in the Chicago suburbs, and our lead singer was – He moved around a lot on stage. The rest of us didn't really move around a lot, but he was all over the place because that was part of our show, was, you know, him being him.
Right.
And he goes to, like, jump at one point and steps on something on the stage as he lands, and he comes, like, right towards me. As I'm sitting at – I'm crammed into the corner of this stage, like, I'm, like – arms like up like this. I can barely get all my stuff in there. I had to pare my kit down to only two cymbals and everything. I had to get rid of a whole bunch of stuff on my kit. And he comes like flying like ass first right into my drum kit. This is skit. Like, I'm like, oh, this is it. I'm going to die right here. And he's going to smash me into the corner. All this drum stuff's going to just like right in the throat. I'm done. All right. I got to get back to the thing I was getting to before with the Creed thing. Because there's a lot of people in that like 25 to 35 range that hate Creed, hate Nickelback. Any other bands you can think of that are kind of in that same era that people are just like, that's just awful, like Limp Bizkit?
Well, I mean, I don't know, like, I'm not a huge fan. I'm not even, like, really, I don't call myself a fan of those bands, dude. But I just want, my question is, how do you get thrown into a category where you're just, like, the biggest fucking joke band in the world? Like, how did, like, a Nickelback, like, yeah. That's like the... It's almost like a punchline now. You know what I mean? Like,
jokes.
How do you?
I've
get
made jokes about them before. Too.
How does that happen? You know what I mean? It's just like these guys have written like these mega crazy hits. They have tons of money. It's not like they're just some bar band from Joe Blow Sports Bar in Tupelo, Mississippi. Like these guys are like filthy rich. But and honestly, it's like successful whether you're a fan of it or not. Like you can't deny that they have it. You know that they're successful, but how do you get thrown into a category where you're just like, I don't want to listen to that shit ever? Like, how does that happen? You know what I mean?
See, I'm glad that you're kind of on the same wavelength as me with this, because it doesn't make any sense to me that they sell millions of records, they make millions of dollars, they have these massive tours that people go to.
Yeah, they sell them out.
They sell out their tours. It doesn't make any sense. I don't know where it came from. Maybe
did
it's
you
just...
ever read the review that dude gave Nickelback on like their whatever album it was and tour they were doing like several years ago? And he said like he gave explanations of like examples, excuse me, what you could do with your money instead of buying that record and going to the show.
Really?
And one of the examples he had given was that you could go to some Ace Hardware and buy like 32 hammers would be better than buying the record and going to the show. So how do you get thrown? I would hate to think like this Goldie stuff comes out or any kind of Cruelty of the Heavens stuff happens.
Yeah.
And then somebody says, you know, you can go buy fucking some Quikrete and port, you know, put a post in your backyard rather than buy that record.
Do you think if Green Day had, if social media had been what it is now when Green Day was blowing up, that they would have had that same problem, that people would have treated them the same way?
Probably. I almost think they're walking that fence now, especially with that American Idiot record when they come back out and they, you know, they all had the black hair and the guy liner and shit going on. People weren't expecting that. You know, when you deliver something for so long, like people get into like, you know, like they kind of have an expectation of what you're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go and you reach too far. Like, I don't know. I guess it's just to keep a career or to keep younger people, because when Dookie come out, it was like 1994.
Yeah.
So all those kids are like grown as fuck working, you know, at some fucking huge company somewhere making tons of money or whatever. They don't go to shows and stop going to shows fucking 20 years ago or whatever. But I guess it's just to keep a career. I guess I can understand that because, you know, if you've ever had a job a day in your life, you know that you have to do things in that job to keep it and to keep moving. So
they've kept themselves relevant for sure.
So that, I mean... I just don't really care. I wouldn't do it personally. I couldn't imagine somebody coming up and saying, "Hey, Neil, we're gonna need you to cut your. We need you to have a bowl cut at the next show, or we're gonna need you to put some makeup on, man. You're gonna really have to do it. We're gonna fill these seats up if you just put a little blush on, dude. Just come on, man. Do it for the fans. Like I couldn't do that. That's questioning my integrity as a musician, artist, and person.
When they signed to a major label back in like what was it like 93 or whatever before Dookie came out, they got criticized by all these people back in the San Francisco scene. Like, oh, you guys sold out and all this stuff.
They were spitting on them at shows. They went back to their hometown or whatever to play, and all these people were like spitting on them, throwing bottles and just different things at them because they didn't think that they should have signed a contract or whatever, you know.
But if you listen to the music, though, if you take the music that they put out before they were on a major label, it sounds just like the stuff they were doing after they were on the major label. It's just more polished.
Right.
It's like, say, I almost kind of wonder if they would have gotten that same treatment that where it was like, oh, you like Green Day? Well,
of course, when somebody has a fucking Sex Pistols shirt on or something, like, oh, you think that's punk, dude? You ever heard the fucking Clash before? You suck, man. Like, you don't know what punk is, man. This dude thinks Blink-182 is punk over here, you know, and making a fucking spectacle out of you. Of course, yeah, there's always going to be people like that, and there's always going to be the people that don't understand why you can't come to every Joe Blow show that blows through town, because when you work 12 hours a day and you have, you know, responsibilities of someone your age, you can't make it to every show. You would like to, but things like that, I mean, you're not 16, 17 anymore, you know what I mean? And it just, like, we all talk about in the band, too. Like, we just can't, like, jump in a van anymore.
Yeah.
And just go and just see what happens and sleep on people's floors. And maybe we'll make $20 at this next show and we can put a little gas in the van and keep going. You just realistically, you can't, because everything you've worked for thus far in music or in your personal life will just collapse. It'll crumble and you'll lose everything.
Do you feel like as a Memphis musician that there's a certain level of expectations that people in the community might have looking at you going that you're a band from Memphis, you need to be doing X, Y, Z to a certain point? Or is that just kind of like – because that was always kind of the perception
I feel
that
like because all I've ever done, man, all I've ever been a part of was heavy music. Either if I was playing drums or if I was singing or whatever the case may be, it was always heavy music. And this Cruelty of the Heavens record is the first time that I've ever done anything like that ever. Sure. But I've always loved that music. That's what inspired me to play music, was records like that. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't the guy playing the fastest as he could, because I just can't, like, I loved it as a kid. Like, it made me feel great. It made me angry and it made me just want to tear shit up. But I didn't really... I can't connect with it in the way that I can with a band like Slow Dive or, you know, whatever. One of my favorite bands is Looked Over 90s band, Super Drag.
Oh, yeah.
You need to listen to fucking Head Trip in Every Key is one of the greatest records ever written by that band and just in general. But, like, the point is, I think people want you to keep doing that stuff. They don't want, yeah. They expect, you know, it's an expectation kind of thing. Like, you've been doing heavy music this whole time. Like, I don't really like the 90s nod. I don't really like slow. I don't like you anymore now that you're doing that. Well, that's fine, because I'm a musician. I'm an artist. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that'd be like you telling Picasso, like, hey, man, you can't use yellow and orange. Like, he would probably tell you to go fuck yourself. You know what I mean? So... how are you going to tell somebody that writes music and loves music and what they can do and what they can play and how they should play it? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. How are you going to tell me that? Or just anybody in general? It's about playing like what you feel and what you want, what's in your heart, and just what makes you feel good. You know what I mean? It's one thing being like super young and you're playing shit to impress your friends and all your friends are coming out. You know what I mean? But then once you keep doing it, it's more about yourself. It's not a selfish kind of thing, but in a way it is, because you're playing things that you want to hear that make you feel good. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You don't care about your friend no more. You don't care about, oh, well, Scotty loves breakdowns. I don't give a fuck about Scotty at this point. I want to play what I want to play, and if you want to be a part of this with me and you want to come along and experience just some fun times, then let's do it. But as far as putting out a heavy record, in Chaos Order, we put two records out a year for 5 fucking years. And the last thing we did was went and recorded with Steve Albini. Mm-hmm. And that was the icing on the cake right there. Like, this is it. Like, this is – I never thought I'd be in the same room with this guy.
Yeah.
But it's all about doing what's in your heart, not what Scotty wants you to do, you know?
Tell
Scotty to fucking learn to play an instrument and start his own fucking band that sucks.
Thank you for that.
Yeah.
Like, one of the best bands I was ever in, when we first started, we were doing a lot of pop punk music, and we were doing covers in our sets just to fill space.
Right.
And we realized we were going down the wrong road with that when people were coming to the shows to hear us play cover songs. And we're like, no, we're not. We slowly started taking the cover songs out of the set. And over time, we noticed that people were kind of like getting more and more disinterested for a while. They're like, hey, man, how come you're not playing that one Weezer song anymore? It's like, because we're not fucking Weezer.
We're not Weezer. You realize that's not our fucking song? That's a Weezer song, man.
So it is. After a while, we started getting rid of it. And that's why after a while, we were like, we need to put cover songs back in the set just to kind of liven things up a little bit. We're like, what are we doing? We can't do this. And it took us a while to figure out, like, why we were having a hard time finding a song to pull. We were going to do, like, one cover song a night. But we wanted it to be really, really good. We wanted it to sound like us, right. Not like us right. Playing somebody else.
Right.
And after a while, it's just kind of like, what are we doing? We don't need to do this. Like, we're going to play 8 songs instead of 9. We'll play 8 songs, but we'll play our songs.
Right.
And we're not going to play Sloppy Meat Eaters or whoever it was that we were covering at the time, or some weird Outcast cover that we would we would do from time to time.
Right.
Like, we'll play our 8 songs. If people don't like it, oh well, they don't have to come see us the next time. But if they like those 8 songs we're doing, they'll come and see us again.
Well, you don't, if you're not billing yourself as a cover band, it's nice to have 1 or 2 in the set, maybe one. But if you're not billing yourself as a cover band, you shouldn't be asked to, you know, to continue to play covers every time that you play this certain spot, you know what I mean, by somebody. Like, do you realize that we write all original music?
Have you ever played at a venue like that where they book you and they're like, hey, do you guys play cover songs?
Oh, God. Yeah, I mean, we've had people ask us to do, like, just silly shit, man. Like, Chaos Order, man, it's a punk thrash metal weird. It's a weird influence band. So why would you ever come up and ask us to, like, cover something like, you know, whatever the fuck? We've been asked to cover Weezer before. Foo Fighters. Hey, y'all know Everlong? Like, yeah, I know the song, but we're not going to fucking play it tonight. Anyway, this next song, you know, and just fucking go right into something else. I don't. Some people just don't get it, man. Like, they're clueless to what's really happening in front of them. They don't know, and it just. I know what it's like to be young at a show and not really understand what's going on, but when you're fucking older than me coming up to me asking me to play Foo Fighters for you, something's not – either you've had too much to drink or you're not all there.
One of my favorite things that my band ever did was we were playing a gig at a junior high school, like outside, and it's all these other bands that are playing. They're all playing like a bunch of cover songs and stuff. We're the only band that's playing all original music. So we decided that all these 12 and 13-year-old girls, this is like 2006, so Fall Out Boy was like really popular amongst the 13-year-olds at that point. Two or three different times during the set, we would say, oh yeah, this is a song by Fall Out Boy, and we'd start playing the Fall Out Boy song and go right into our song.
Right.
So if you get that 5 to 10 seconds of the girls all hugging and jumping up and on, oh my God, oh my God. And then we'd go into our song.
Yep.
Yeah. Oh my God. That is the most satisfying thing to watch the joy turn to disgust on someone's face.
Yeah. I've had the pleasure of doing that many times with original music, you know, just making people sick and wanting to leave. And I know that we played a show one time, and I think it was the same show at Murphy's. Where the top of my head was caved in, because we're jumping around. At one point, I see like this little thing, man. He's like 4'3" probably, and he's in a leprechaun outfit. I swear, with the beard. I'm not even joking, man. And he's pointing at me like mad, like point, like yeah.
Are you sure he was real? And
that's what
just
I was
like
saying. Like, man, I just got hit in the head. Like, I got a bad concussion. Like, this guy's not real. And so. We're playing, I'm jumping around, I turn my back for a second, and he's gone. Never see him again. I was like, I'm not going to even mention this guy. Like, I'm not even going to mention seeing him. I'm going to wait till somebody else says something. And it wasn't until we were unloading our equipment back at our practice space that another guy in the band was like, did you see that guy in that leprechaun's uniform or outfit or whatever? I was like, oh, thank hell. Like, I just thought, like, I'm going to have to go to the doctor. Like, I've got, like, an aneurysm or something. My brain is bleeding.
Leprechauns.
But he was... Man, he was mad, dude, about something. I don't know what happened. Were we playing the wrong song, or he couldn't hear the vocals, something. He was just, man, he was mad at me. But it was funny.
So as we kind of start to wrap things up with this, because we're at almost an hour already, what do you want to see, maybe not just from yourself, but just the music scene in this community in general?
More camaraderie, more people getting together and it being... a fun thing, and I don't know, I just kind of feel like over time that's kind of went away in a little way, in a small way. It just, I don't know if it's because I'm getting older that I feel like that, but I just feel like when I go to a show, it's a weird vibe in the air, kind of like it's,
do you think
pick
it's
your side, like who are you, you know, kind of like who are you with, kind
of
thing.
Do you think it's because a lot of the, it's because everybody's getting a little bit older, there's more of a divide, or is it?
It could be, and it just like the younger people coming up, and You know, I don't know. I just more camaraderie and being like more of a hangout than you going to a show to kick someone's ass or, you know, to cause trouble. Because I know that when I first started going to shows, man, being 12, 13 years old, instead of going to the skating rink, you know, you go to a show and that's the only thing you've done all week, that you're looking forward to that because mm-hmm. of everything else that you have to do as a young man or young woman or whatever. That's one thing you're looking forward to, and then to think that you're going to those shows to have somebody treat you badly or talk really bad to you or, you know, break your fucking nose. You know, it's all, you know, if you get your nose broken and you're moshing around, whatever the case may be, if it's all in fun, that's one thing. But
sure.
just somebody setting out to, you know, alienate you is, I don't know, I just think it's ridiculous. Like, it's, let's have fun with it.
Is part of the problem maybe like an over-commercialization of things in a way that, like, bands are looking more to be more kind of just quote-unquote professional and not have, just have fun?
I don't know. I just have my own opinion about it. Like, I don't know. I haven't read this anywhere.
Sure.
And, I have my own, like, just I see things the way that I see them. Somebody else that may sit in this chair may say something completely different from what I'm saying, but it's just this the way that I see it. A little more camaraderie, you know, sure. Be a little bit more accepting of people and the music that they like and the things that, I mean, you can read stories where back in the late 80s, early 90s in New York City where you would have a big warehouse full of people and it would be a death metal band, it would be a hardcore band, it would be a rap group, it would be a thrash band, it would be this band, all on the same bill, all in the same room hanging out, drinking beer together at the bar. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it needs to be more stuff like that where it's a more of a – it's – I don't know, just the camaraderie. I don't know. It just – that's that makes you want to go to a show. It makes you
exactly.
look forward to it like, man, I'm going to get to see X amount of bands tonight, and we're going to get to see a rap group play of all things, you know?
You'll get opened up to so many more types of music that way.
Right, and there's – the room is just full of all walks of life from – all kind of cultures, man, and it's really interesting, and it's really a great feeling when all those people are in the same room together, and it's really good. It's just it's one of those feelings that it's unexplainable. You can't explain that when you actually are a part of something like that. And I think that there are a lot of guys that are trying to bring that back now.
Yeah,
like they're working to make that happen, and there's a lot of big shows that are happening in Memphis that. That hasn't been happening in a long time.
Sure.
So there's a lot of good things going on, man. There really is. It's coming up, man, and it hit a low for a second. Like, it's, yeah.
There's a lot of great places to play in town.
Oh,
now,
yeah,
too,
man.
So.
I mean, it really is. And there's a lot of great fucking bands here, man. There's
yeah.
a ton of talented people here. Tons, man. Some of these people, I'm looking forward to their records coming out. Like, I'm ready to hear them. I'm ready to hear what this sounds like. So, yeah, it's all about just trying to explore and trying to find new music that you'll find these guys. You know, it's all about just trying to get out and see. But that's one thing that I would like to see is a little bit more camaraderie and diverse shows as far as it doesn't matter if it's a metal band, or I would like to think that Cruelty of the Heavens could get up there and play with any band we wanted to in Memphis, you know what I mean?
Sure.
Whether it be metal, hardcore, or, you know, whatever. You know what I mean? I don't want to just have, like, well, if you're not, like, a 90s kind of feel band, I don't know, man. Whatever, dude. Let's play music. Let's have fun. Like,
or saying you've got to put the Goldie stuff on a show with a bunch of, like, quieter, mellow type of...
I'm going to tell you, I mean, yeah, I mean, I'll play with whoever, but this stuff may, depending on what you're expecting, you know, if you're, I wouldn't want to open for Slayer, like, with this stuff, you know, I'd have, like, rocks thrown at me, probably.
Within reason. It's always within reason.
Right, man. There's limitations to everything, but you know what I'm trying to say.
Sure. So, with all the, we've kind of touched on it various times throughout this. What stuff have you got coming up, coming out? Any shows coming up? Where are people going to be finding you around town?
Well, you can follow Cruelty of the Heavens on Instagram. That record, Grow Up and See, actually in a couple more months has been out a year. Encapsulated Records from St. Louis. I know. St. Louis put that out. actually working with Ed Harris on the guitar parts because he's going to play guitar in the band sure. with us. So we're getting really close to doing our first show with that band. We've never played a show with that band ever. That record got released, and we never played a show. There's that. The Goldie and Omerta split that Ed and myself are doing for charity.
Mm-hmm.
That'll be out probably somewhere in October. We're just trying to figure out what charity it's going to be because we don't want to say any names because sure. you don't want to go back on a charity. You know what I mean? You don't yep. want to do that. And so just kind of looking forward to releasing a lot more music. I know that Cruelty, we have three songs that we've been sitting on for, I know, at least 8 months now. That one of the songs actually features Grace Askew. She come and sing on one of the songs, and it's more of the direction that we're going in the band.
Yeah,
it's a little bit more of the Cure and Slow Dive and things like that.
Sure,
but it'll be interesting to get that out, and hopefully we'll be able to do a split with another band that we can't mention just yet. But
sure,
in case it falls through.
So throw the name out there. Throw them under the bus.
I know. I'm gonna come. That's gonna be a different show because I'm gonna come back for like another hour, and then I'm just gonna rant about that band the entire time. But we'll save that for the next time.
You got any Chaos Order stuff still unreleased yet? I thought I saw something about that one day.
You know, not to my knowledge. You know, we have a lot of material in that band. There's sure. a lot of stuff, man. The last thing that we did was with Steve Albini in 2015. That was the last time that we were in a studio together, and that was the last songs that we ever worked on. And one of those songs actually made it over to the Cruelty of the Heavens record, 1995.
Yeah, yeah.
Steve actually recorded the original version of that song with Chaos Order. It was a Chaos Order song at one time.
That's so awesome.
Yep.
I'm forever jealous that you got to go record with Steve Albini because growing up in Illinois, Northern Illinois specifically, like that was a dude that it was like, you gotta go work with
him. He's the most down to earth dude you'll ever meet. This guy rode a 10-speed bicycle to the studio every day. He lives like 3 miles away. He rode his 10-speed to work every day, put his jumpsuit on. He drank coffee the entire time. He would not eat. He drank coffee the entire time. He actually has a fake Facebook page where like he has a board. And then right next to the board where all his outboard gear is, there's a laptop set up there. And in between takes and us listening to stuff, he would be on the computer. And I would just ask, like, hey, what are you doing? Like, what is that? Are you on Facebook? He's like, yeah, you know, I just, like, troll people on here. So Steve Albini has a fake Facebook where he, like, you know, says smart-ass things to people.
Oh, my God.
And he goes home every night and he cooks for his wife, man. He goes home and
really?
Cooks dinner for her, and he writes about it on a food blog that he's a part of. But he's, like, the most down-to-earth dude, and he's, like, the first guy you've ever recorded with. Like, the first time you were in a studio, you went in, you had the songs ready, they're prepared, and you recorded them. The guy just hit the button. That's what he does. He don't mess with your music. What you do is what you do. He don't change yeah. anything about it. Everything you hear with him is what the band has done. He has no input. He will not lobby to change anything. He's not into it.
If you ask him, would he give you suggestions on stuff? Or
No. He was just kind of, you know, if you messed something up or you flubbed a part, he would let you know, like, hey, this time around, like, it's a little bit different than the first time. I don't know if that's supposed to be there or not. And, you know, yeah. obviously it wasn't. It was just kind of a fuck-up or whatever. But I got to talk about Nirvana, The Breeders, Pixies, Neurosis, Jesus Lizard.
Man.
All these bands with him, especially because I was Nirvana was the band for
yep.
me. Like, I loved that band when I was mm-hmm. growing up. I wanted to be Dave Grohl for a long time.
I still want to be Dave Grohl.
Yeah, yeah, within limitations. I do. You know what I mean? There's a lot of things I don't want to, you know, I don't want to have to carry around the suicide of my friend, you know?
So fair enough.
Just being able to talk to him about those kind of things is it was bucket list in itself, but him just being, like, really cool and down to earth and just being, like, one of your buddies, it was unreal. You know, because you kind of, like, you paint these pictures in your head of how somebody may be.
Yeah.
And then you meet them, and it's, like, completely different. So it just kind of, like, whacks you out for a second. Are you being serious right now, or are you fucking with me? You being serious? And he was, like, super cool, man. But just talking about those bands with him, just bands that have influenced me and just everybody in my band at the time was just really cool, man. Bucket list.
Awesome. All right, where can people find you on? I know you're on social media. Where can people find you at?
Find me? Do you need my address to my house? You want people to come to my house?
Sure. Why not?
You can find the bands on Instagram, Cruelty of the Heavens. We're on Facebook also. You can go do the fan page on there. You can get the Cruelty record from, there's Shangri-La carries it here in Memphis. You can also order it from encapsulatedrecords.com. They have it there. It's on Spotify. It's on iTunes. It's anywhere that digital music can be found and played. It's on YouTube. We have videos on YouTube. Just everywhere.
Awesome. Thanks, Neil. It was a pleasure having you in here today. We got to do this again sometime.
Oh, yeah, man. Let me know. Thank you, man, for having me. And this has been really fun, and I really appreciate it.
Big thanks to Neil for coming on the show today. Neil's just great. He's a very interesting guy, and I knew you guys would enjoy hearing some of his thoughts on the music business and his influences, my influences, too. But yeah, Neil was great. Next week's show, going to do a little bit of college football talk and NFL talk, too. It's going to be all football show next week, which that'll be dropping next Friday, 6 a.m. next Friday. So as we close things out today, I'm going to give you guys Him and Her, first song off of Neil's Goldie EP, split EP with Omerita and Ed Harris. So thanks, guys, for downloading, streaming. You can find me on Twitter at Greg Ratliff, on Instagram at Greg Ratliff. I think that's about it. So again, thank you guys for listening, downloading, whatever you guys do to check out the show. I appreciate it. Please go to my Patreon page. You can help keep the show going every week by going to the page and donating. And it would mean the world to me if you guys did that. So that's patreon.com/Greg Ratliff. Thanks, guys. Y'all have a good week. We out. Smith.
The New York Times, Rolling Stone, and critics everywhere are all raving about Annihilation.
It's not destroying. It's making something new.
It's a mind-blowing experience. And now it's certified fresh on Rotten Tomatoes. Annihilation. Rated R. Now playing. The New York Times, Rolling Stone, and critics everywhere are all raving about Annihilation.
It's not destroying. It's making something new.
It's a mind-blowing experience. And now it's certified fresh on Rotten Tomatoes. Annihilation. Rated R. Now playing.